Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Jeremy Scott Fitness Podcast Radio Show, coming to you on this Friday, July the 7th, 2023. Hopefully it finds you staying safe and staying sweaty all at the same time. On today's episode, we are talking about food addiction, binge eating, and how to identify what's going on, kind of break down some of the layers, and hopefully give you a better path to creating a plan moving forward if this is something that you struggle with. And I'll kind of touch on the addiction stuff from all fronts, and then we'll just connect the dots from there. But just some quick housekeeping things. One, our next challenge on the app is kicking off here on July the 17th. I just got all of the links and the promo information from that. Is our 34-day ab and core challenge. Now, it's not, you know, your mom and dad's core challenge. It's not just lay on the ground and do sit-ups and crunches. It is actually far from it. It's very dynamic. It's very diverse. If you've never done a version of this with us before, there's going to be things you are doing in here that you have never done before, complexes and sequences that are completely unique to really challenge your trunk integrity. So meaning not just rectus like the front six, but your obliques, your intercostals, obviously the erectors, your entire pelvic bowl, your hips, shoulder integration. We kind of mix everything in and we do it the most functional, you know, direct, quote unquote, ab work way possible. So the link is going to be obviously in the show notes here. It's jeremyscottfitness.app/34-days-abs-challenge. It's a long URL. But the link's here below, you guys. It's also in my Instagram bio. It's going to come out on the emails every day for the next week or so. We start on the 17th, and then you guys have, I believe, until the 23rd to register and actually be eligible for, obviously, the weekly prizes with all our sponsors. But then we are doing another free trip for this one. We just gifted the last one for the Summer MetCon Challenge this week. That person's going to fly out here to Scottsdale, hang out here for a couple of days at one of the hotels and resorts, get to come in here in the gym and crush it with us. And we're doing the same thing for the 34-day abs and core challenge. So it's a chance for you guys, obviously, to win a bunch of stuff that we believe in, a bunch of our swag, but also one of you, we actually pay for your flight out here. We pay for your hotel stay. We invite you in here. You can work out with us and the Savages, and we can have a great time. So all of that, plus you really get to learn about core training on a much, much deeper level in a way that makes actual sense for your body and challenges you, you know, not just to be laying on the ground doing bicycle crunches all day. Not that those don't have their place, but it's much, much deeper than that. Obviously, I talk about food with everything else, and if you guys are in there, you get full app access as well. So free for the app members. All you got to do is just sign up, and then everybody else, you can do a week for free. And if you want to get down after that, stay with us and maybe win a bunch of free stuff that pays for your membership and then some 10 times over. Also, what do we got going on today? We're brought to you by my friends at, you already know, AG1. Again, www.drinkag1.com/JeremyScott. We are giving you guys a year's supply of free vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first order. If this is the first episode you've listened to, or maybe you're a psychopath and you've listened to all 545 episodes as of today, you know this is the one thing I take every single day and I never miss. It's easy to travel with. Summer is when we take most of our trips to see friends and family. I just got back from Minnesota. Took Athletic Greens every single day I was there. Feel like a rock star, looking like a rock star. It helps, especially because some of those days I'm eating, you know, only one meal. And oftentimes it's at a nice, what I like to say, Midwestern restaurant where sometimes you just got to go with, you know, walleye and chips, man. Like, that's it. And they don't have a lot of green vegetables. And the ones they do have are basically trash. So I do the best I can, but I do take the greens every single day, especially when I travel. It's kind of my covering the gaps in what I don't get because I'm, you know, trying to be quote unquote like a normal person, still making the best choices I can. But this helps me get all the fruits and vegetables and micronutrients I need for the day. So if you're somebody who's tired of taking 15 different pills, you don't want to travel with, you know, your grandma's pill case, and you find yourself not taking them, this to me is the best kind of foundational nutritional supplement you can do because it's easy. I don't dread taking it. It's the best tasting, in my opinion, helps your gut health, can help boost your energy, support your immune system. And again, you're not going to make an excuse not to take it because you just literally rip it, put it in some water, shake it, and you're good to go. So If you want to take ownership of your health, obviously you have to eat real food, you have to exercise and take care of yourself. But if you're looking for a kind of all-in-one encompassing things, I think AG1 is going to be it. So again, if you want to check it out, hit us up. AG1.com/JeremyScott gets you a year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with order 1. And if you're still on the fence and you want to try it for free, shoot me a message. DM us, email us, contact us wherever you can. We will send a pack right to your front door for free. 100%. It's not going to cost you anything. All you do is send us your full name and your mailing address. We've sent out, if I had to guess, probably 2,000 sample packs of AG1 to people. And I'm happy to do so. If it helps you be like, you know what, actually, I do like the taste, or, you know, I can handle the taste, or it's something easy I can do, and it helps you be healthier, I'm happy to eat the cost. So reach out to us, send us your info, and we'll send you a pack right to your front door for free. Otherwise, check out the link, drinkag1.com/JeremyScott, in the show notes to get all the free stuff today. All the other podcast sponsors are in the show notes. I'm too lazy today and I have too much shit going on to read them all, so I'm sorry, everybody else. But if you can look below, all our friends at JLab Pro, our friends at Dry Farms Wine, Kettle and Fire, and then, of course, Sleeves Sold Separately, where I get all my joggers and hoodies. We have discounts on all of those things below from all the awesome people we partner with. Now, what else do we got going on here? Just finished up some email stuff here for our mastermind group with Dave DiLorenzo and myself, just working on the kind of website copy, getting everything together in terms of graphics, talking to some people today on coaching calls about that moving forward. I'm just going to throw it out here quick. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're somebody in a small to medium-sized business and you want to take it to the next level in your career, whatever that means for you, whether that's more revenue, whether that's scaling, whether it's work-life balance, whether it's just, you know, building an ideal business and an ideal life. If you're somebody who's in a corporate job, but maybe you want to take your passion project or your side hustle to the next level and you want, you know, kind of a blueprint and a playbook of how to build it out, this would be a group for you. If I had to guess, we'll get this thing live towards the end of the year, and then we'll start the official January, February, March. We're going to do these things, you know, year after year after year. I'm not going to get into too many details, but I do think it is something super helpful for people. Obviously, you know, I started doing this before social media. Obviously, we've created these platforms where we can reach, you know, literally over 1 million people a week, which is fucking crazy to say. I took this business from, you know, literally training people in a park, you know, to generating millions of dollars in fitness, which to me is still fucking wild. Actually, even talking to Heather last night, I just said, hey, you know, if it all ended today, you know, from when you met me at a bar, you know, dead broke with no money and no job, if I told you, you know, 15 years from now, this is what it would be, you know, this has exceeded anything that we have ever thought was possible. And I got here, obviously, by, you know, a ridiculous amount of stupid ass hard work for almost 2 decades, but really just beg, borrow, and stealing, and listening to and being a beginner with all of the people I've had access to, which is some of the smartest people, you know, in the world, in my opinion, in all their fields. But I've been lucky enough to hang out with, you know, hundreds of, you know, millionaires and multimillionaires and people who have damn near $1 billion doing this in this business. So I've learned a lot, and I would like to give that back to other people. And Dave is in the same boat. He's built an amazing business, you know, that is worth a lot of money, and he's made a lot of money, and he's done it through building relationships and helping people and just, you know, putting boots on the ground. And that's what this group is all about. So that'll be our mastermind group. That'll be coming out towards the end of the year. So if you're somebody who's thinking about it, obviously it's going to be an investment of your time. It'll be an investment of your money, but I'm more than confident we can take what you're currently doing and elevate it to the next level, whatever that looks like for you. And I think that's the most important piece. It's not just about making more money, which that you will do, but more importantly, build a business and build a life that works around you and your skill sets and what you want to do. So that is what I've been working on as of late. So before I kick into the food addiction episode here, I want to read one quick thing here from Mike Samuels, but my phone is just going off here like crazy because I got a bunch of knuckleheads just messaging me. But what the messages, Mike Samuel put this out, about Warren Buffett, and kind of goes hand in hand with just time, effort, energy, focus, and just kind of sticking to the path. I'm going to read here real fast. Again, I've talked about Mike on here quite a bit. He's a copywriter. He puts out great stuff. And this is another gem I saved, man, probably a couple weeks back here. And I quote, as I write this, Warren Buffett's net worth is $84.5 billion with a B. That's crazy. Off of that, $84.2 billion. So right now he has $84.5. Of that $84.5, $84.2 billion was accumulated after his 50th birthday. How wild is that? $81.5 billion came after he qualified for Social Security in his mid-60s. Warren Buffett is a phenomenal investor, but you miss a key point if you attach all of his success to just his investing acumen. The real key to his success is that he's been a phenomenal investor for three quarters of a century. Morgan Housel, The Psychology of Money, writes, I often have a wry smile when people who achieve success in what they do talk about their secret without mentioning the time served. Yes, there are people who strike it lucky and achieve fame and fortune without really doing much, but they are few and far between. By and large, the most overlooked aspect in those people who have done anything great is the timing. It's rarely the case you'll find someone who has had sustained success, be that in finance, business, sports, music, art, anything, that hasn't been practicing their craft for decades. So yes, while there are absolutely things you can do to speed up the process and shortcuts you can take, ultimately, if you want to be successful at something, you have to start as early as possible, do it as often as possible, keep going, even when other people quit, and wash, rinse, repeat for 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. And that's the end note here. Now, oddly enough, I was talking to my boy Mike D today, just about timing, kind of like this message is here, and how the timing of things has just, you know, been opportune for me in some things for sure. Some things I was early, some things I was late, but some things I hit, you know, right on the nose. And I don't know if you call that, you know, destiny or luck or whatever the fuck you want to call it. But on top of all that, what we talked about is just the consistency to do something for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And a lot of times people do stuff for 3 years or 5 years or even 10 years, and they think that, you know, magic things should instantly happen. And that has not been the case for me, and that's not the case for most people. Him and I were talking today, you know, how he can get on the phone and hop on and, you know, he can make the right two contacts and he can get a bunch of stuff done. And younger people in his field will ask, you know, hey, how the hell do you do that? He's like, well, I've been doing this for 30 years. You know, you learn a lot over the course of multiple decades. You know, you fail, you fuck up, and then you learn from those things and you build relationships and you refine your craft and you get better. And when you know better, you do better. But it takes time and you have to do the reps. And I guess that's kind of just the takeaway. I know a lot of people get discouraged when things don't happen right away. And when I say right away, I think people misinterpret that as like, well, you know, you tried it for 6 months and it didn't work. No. If I give this podcast for an example, which has become the number one, I guess, kind of relationship builder in everything that we do, because you get people's attention for hours and hours and hours on end. And there is people who are listening who have listened to, you know, 75% of the episodes, 50% of the episodes. Some people listen to 100% of the episodes we've put out, which is fucking wild. And we thank you guys for that. And I'm always humbled. But if I got discouraged by doing this, and if I told you today that this podcast can generate more revenue, you know, than people I could train in person, you know, even if it's large groups, it's pretty impressive, no matter how you slice it. And that is the case today. This thing generates money. We reach a lot of people. It's become fun to do. I've gotten to meet a lot of amazing people. I've learned a lot. But this podcast didn't make any money. In fact, it cost me money for probably the first 200 to 300 episodes, if I had a guess. I don't know exactly when it started making like dollars, but I can promise you the first 200 episodes, I didn't make a fucking dollar on this. I lost money because I was paying for, obviously, the equipment. I was investing time learning how to do a podcast, sitting with other people who had done one, learning about equipment, learning about the platforms and how they work, because I didn't know anything. And if you think about that, well, what does that mean in terms of time, Jeremy? Let's say the first 300 episodes of this made me $0, and I actually spent money and then took money from other things and built this up. If I just did 50 episodes or 52 episodes, if there's 52 weeks in a year, and the first, let's say, 300 episodes were worth nothing, that would mean year one, year two, year three, year four, and like year five, $0. Now, some of the years I do like 100 episodes, so maybe that cuts the timeline down. And let's say the first 3 years of doing this, zero money. So sitting here by myself speaking into the ether or speaking to guests for hours, doing research before that for hours, learning how to upload the podcast and write the copy and build everything out, you got to think how many hours that is, how many weeks and months and years went by where nothing happened and I didn't make a single cent. And so when we look at success and we look at people who are doing well, and we look at people who are crushing it, and you see people doing the things that you think you want to do, just know there is a ridiculous amount of sacrifice of time, effort, and energy, and the amount of dedication that would rival a fucking crazy person. Because if you told somebody, hey man, you got to do this podcast for at least two times a week, every week for 3 years, and you got to do it for hours, and you got to get real guests, and you got to bring in your friends and convince them to do it, even though there isn't shit in it for them, and you're going to do all that with the promise of making no money and maybe start to make a dollar in year three or four or five, that's wild. But I think if you look at anybody in terms of their physical body or their career or their relationship or their finances or whatever it is, the story is very similar. There's so many sets and reps and hours of studying and learning and failing and trying that go into it that you never see. And that's the real secret for most people. It's the time served. It's the what you do in private, you get praise for in public. And that goes as true for your fitness as it does for anything in life. So that's my quick message before we even jump into the episode today. Sorry, you guys, if you want to talk food addiction, I got off track a little bit, but I do think that that's important because oftentimes it gets overlooked. And maybe it's easier for me just because I suck at everything naturally, and everything I do, I'm not good at right away, and I fuck up and I fail and I have to learn and relearn and try again. And it's just, I don't know. I'm just stubborn enough, and I'm stupid enough, and I'm crazy enough to work hard to just, you know, make it happen. And I think if you can, you know, find some of that in yourself, you'll be successful in anything you do. But just keep putting in the reps, keep serving the time, you guys, and it'll pay off. It might not be a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now, but eventually, it will pay off. So we're talking food addiction here. And this is an original piece that comes from my friends at PN over at Precision Nutrition. The two authors of the original script, Alex Picot Anand and Elnaz Mokhimi, I think I'm saying that right. If not, I apologize. I'll put the link in the show notes. PhD, and obviously Alex is a holistic nutritionist. Great stuff over at PN. They've done a lot for the industry. We've had Dr. John Berardi, the original founder, on. It's a great episode. I think it's one of my top five all-time episodes ever listened to. He's a genius and a wealth of knowledge for sure. And so they put out really good stuff. But this is on food addiction. And I'm going to talk about food addiction in here. I'll talk about some of my addictions a little bit. And then we'll talk about binge eating and just some habits and some hacks to hopefully help you guys get a little bit healthier. But it's the phrase, you know, I can't stop thinking about food. And have you guys ever felt that way? I'm sure you have. BJ Gadur jokes a lot with me because he can eat so much more than I can. And I always thought I could eat a lot until him and I became close friends and have been to multiple dinners and lunches and brunches over the past probably 10 years. And he'd always joke, you know, if they write the life story of my book, it'll be called In Between Meals. He's like, because all I do is think about food. And I think a lot of you, you know, are similar. And it's normal to think about food a fair bit. And it's normal to occasionally overeat, especially if you're, you know, a big hairy American like I am. But what about food and the thoughts of food that kind of overpower everything else in your life? Like, and what I mean is when you feel an anxiety, when you feel a stress, that's only relieved by eating. And again, you guys can take this and put it into any arena you want, whether that's, it can be relieved by drinking, it can be relieved by smoking a cigarette, it can be relieved by chewing tobacco or watching pornography or, you know, doing cocaine, you name it. Like, these things are interchangeable, but for the sake of the episode, we're talking about food because it's the one you have to do. You have to eat. You know, trust me, you don't have to snort cocaine. You know, you don't have to, you know, take shots of Jägermeister at the bar, but you do have to eat. And you know there's an issue when it seems like you don't have any control over what you eat, when you eat, and how much you eat. And it might make you wonder if that's how you feel if you're listening to this, like, do you have an addiction? And a lot of people throw the word addiction around lightly when you talk about the relationships with food. And some people, including maybe you listening, or maybe if you're a fitness person, some of your clients, they may really be suffering. And so on this podcast, we're going to talk about what is food addiction, how is it different from overeating, why certain foods have more addictive qualities than others, and who's the most vulnerable. And so just a quick note here, as a fitness professional, as a fitness coach, you can't diagnose a food addiction. It's like, it's not in your skill set unless you have like the medical training, like you're a qualified practitioner, which most of you are not. And so while you can't diagnose it for somebody, you can support and be an open ear and an open mind, and you can be an ally to your clients who are dealing with it. And then obviously you can refer out to qualified people who really can help them. And I just want to throw that out there because I think a lot of times we say like, oh, you know, I'm addicted to food. And we're going to talk about what is food addiction. Now, if I look back on my life specifically, like, I was addicted to alcohol and more excessively, maybe not addiction isn't even the right word for that. Like, I was a binge drinker, like real fucking hard, like not two beers, 20 beers, pee my pants, headbutt the wall, blackout, wake up somewhere with one shoe on and try to figure out how the fuck I get home. That was my life. That's more of like the binge part of it, I guess, as opposed to addiction, because I didn't have to do it every single day. Now, in terms of like chewing tobacco, I was addicted. I was addicted in every sense of the word. It took over my life. I would manage so many things in my life around it. I would fiend for it. There's things I would or wouldn't do because of it. When I think about it to this day, the hold it had on me is almost fucking embarrassing, but it really was. And I would tell myself I could quit anytime I wanted to, but I just didn't want to quit, which I think this is what all addicts tend to say. And it took me many, many failed attempts to get out of it. And so that's where we differentiate between like what's binge eating and like what is a food addiction, right? So if we're going to get, you know, per the article here and like what, you know, for clarity's sake, what is food addiction? Food addiction means having an emotional, driven, persistent, and uncontrollable urge to eat, even when you're not physically hungry. Now, full disclaimer here, I don't have a food addiction. I've never had a food addiction. I've binged many times. I have had an unhealthy relationship with food. I have had body dysmorphia for longer than I would like to admit. But if I was not hungry, I wasn't trying to eat. Like, that just wasn't my thing. So a food addiction means you have this emotional, persistent, uncontrollable urge to eat even when you're not hungry. It affects 2 to 11% of people in the Western countries. The rates are the highest probably in the United States, where the research here shows that about 11.4% of the population could be affected. So out of every, like, you know, 100 people, 11 to 12 people have a legit food addiction. So with rates that are this high, you likely know someone who has a food addiction, or maybe you're one of the people who actually struggles with it. And so how do you know? Some of the signs of food addiction: craving increasingly large amounts of usually, and this could be different for each person, high-calorie processed foods in order to feel pleasure, energy, excitement, or to relieve negative emotions, physical pain, or fatigue. So you're craving these huge amounts of highly processed, highly palatable foods. The next thing, spending so much time thinking about and getting food and recovering from overeating that it crowds out recreational activities, professional obligations, and relationships, meaning you opt to food versus doing other things in your life. The next thing, continuing to overeat despite negative effects like digestive problems, unwanted weight gain, and mobility issues. So you know you have a problem, it's physically manifesting itself in multiple ways, yet you're still willing to just pound food over and over and over again. Experiencing withdrawal-like effects, irritability, low mood, headaches, fatigue, when you are not eating. If you overeat at most of your meals or have the occasional out-of-control binge eating episode, are you addicted to food? The answer, not necessarily. And I say this because I have had these out-of-control binge sessions when I was younger. And even though they would cause me, you know, gastrointestinal, you know, distress post, you know, crushing Cold Stone and two pizzas at one time, I would still continue to do it week by week by week. Kind of this eat perfect binge, this vicious cycle I would get in. And despite how bad I would feel, I would push through it, right, the next day, and I would tolerate it. And it's kind of like in college when you'd get so fucked up, you'd be just, you know, hugging the toilet, puking on a Thursday night, and you would just be like, you know, on your knees, throwing up, praying to God, if he just made you feel normal, quote unquote, you would stop drinking. And then obviously the next Thursday comes and you find your dumb ass doing it again. That's like kind of the cycle I was in for food as well. It actually mirrored itself. I didn't learn from the drinking, and I basically just, you know, mirrored it into the eating. But I think everybody pretty much experiences periods of overeating and instances of binge eating. But that doesn't mean to say like you have a legit food addiction. So I'm going to walk through here kind of this breakdown. And so if you follow this, you know, continuum, it's only when urges and compulsive behavior around food becomes severe, frequent, and chronic that a person can be diagnosed with an eating disorder or like a food addiction. And that's kind of the difference. And so there is an infographic here that's actually super helpful. It just talks about like the continuum of eating where you have somebody who is like a balanced eater. This would be, you know, kind of like the ideal. You generally eat to match your energy expenditure, although you may have the occasional or often, you know, unintentional episode of both overeating and undereating. But for the most part, if you are busting your ass and you're moving a ton, you'll eat more. If you're sitting on your ass, not doing as much, you probably eat a little bit less because it's your output and your input are matching. And then sometimes you overeat or undereat, but for the most part, you're a balanced, healthy individual. It probably wasn't until I was, man, I don't know, 30 years old or like 31 years old until I was what I would consider like a balanced, healthy individual for me. And then as every year has went by, I've just refined it, and I've had less failures and fuck-ups. And now at this point, I have so many kind of guardrails in place, and I've won enough battles. I set the parameters, and I don't break them. But even for me, being in this life for basically my entire adult life, it took me, I would say, if I really got into fitness at age, let's say, like post-college, so 22, 23, even though I was an athlete in training, this is when it really took off. It took me probably 7-8 years to really become balanced in my eating, and it took a lot of work on my part. So that's the first one. The next one, the passive overeating. You often eat more than you need, but you don't use food to alter or numb your emotions. You are not distressed over your habits, but you just find yourself overeating more than you like. The next one is loss of control eating. You occasionally are eating compulsively, excessively, and out of control. You know, the phrase like, whoa, I really overdid it. you know, at the Crab Festival this year, or, you know, at the Taco Festival, I ate until, you know, I went crazy, but you're doing that consistently, excessively, and it's more compulsive. Maybe you set out to only have, you know, a couple of bites and you found yourself, you know, 8,000 calories later in a whole different planet. That would be the loss of control eating. The next one is, they call it like the BED, so the binge eating disorder. You binge at least once a week for at least 3 months. Binging means eat a large amount of food, often quickly and in secret, to the point of feeling uncomfortably full. You know, food coma, food baby, or, you know, that you're, you know, one hard laugh away from maybe sharting your pants. And then when you eat, you feel out of control and often feel guilt or shame afterwards. That would be the binge eating disorder. So again, we start at balanced eating to passive overeating to loss of control eating to binge eating disorder. And then finally, it's the food addiction, which is similar to the binge eating disorder, but you may also have this, you know, compulsive need to graze, eating smaller amounts of food almost consistently, often with the feeling that you can't stop. And when you do stop, you may feel withdrawal-like symptoms, creating a hard-to-escape cycle. And as you might notice, like, the binge eating disorder and food addiction share several similarities. But the food addiction, which more closely resembles substance use disorder, is more severe than the binge eating is, because it causes even more disruption in your life. And that would be the biggest thing. For me, I could do the binge eating, but it didn't really fuck up my life. And I do, over the past, you know, 20 years, I've seen a lot of people with the binge eating problems. I've seen a lot of people do the eating in secret, which is really a strange thing, but, you know, it happens, man. We cope with things in life the way that we cope with them. And for some people, food tends to be it. And so I guess the point is, like, how does food addiction, you know, happen? Well, food addiction isn't caused by like a single thing, as you can imagine. For example, you can't just, you know, blame genetics. I'm sure, you know, it plays a part in it for some people, but you have to factor in things like stress in someone's life, how they respond to stress, how lonely they feel, you know, where do they live, who do they spend their time with, also has an impact on their habits. In other words, like most health issues, food addiction comes out of a jumble of biological, psychological, and social factors. There's this multidimensional approach to understanding illness and health. It's called the biopsychosocial perspective. Now, this is all in the PN article. And basically, the biopsychosocial model, if I'm saying that right, you're talking about biology, psychology, and social context. And so what does that mean? Like, the biology is like, how does your body work? Your metabolism, your immunity, your age, your recovery, your hormones, exercise, digestion, all of those things. And you mix that with the psychology. What's your mindset, your thoughts, your feelings, perspective, your memories, your worries, your values, your priorities. And then there's the social context. What's around you? Friends, family, job, coworkers, school, education, your tribe, culture, and society. All of those things make up who you are and what you do. And so in early human history, food scarcity happened on the regular. It's common sense. I talk about the Oregon Trail all the time on here because it is the greatest game in elementary school history that was ever played. But if you look at, you know, what used to happen to survive, humans had to evolve. And humans evolved to overeat when food was abundant, especially when food was tasty and calorie rich. You know, I think back in the day, you found an avocado tree where it's like, oh man, we can eat this. It has a bunch of calories. It has a bunch of fat. It can fill us up. And we're going to eat as much as we can because we don't know when the next meal is going to come or where it's going to come from. But now that instinct that once helped us survive makes it hard to stop eating. And that's a problem. You know, 150 years ago, you couldn't buy 5,000 calories for $5. Now you can, and that's a problem, especially when you have these highly processed foods, the ones that have the perfect combination of sugar and fat and salt and temperature and taste and texture. They're the most difficult to resist. You know, it's why I don't like the phrase when people, you know, when people are, you know, for lack of a better term, sugar Nazis, like, oh, you can't eat sugar. Sugar's going to kill you. Sugar's the most addictive thing in the world. Like, first of all, I'm not saying things with sugar in them aren't addicting, but when people say that, I'm like, have you ever done drugs? Like, have you guys ever done real drugs? Real drugs is more addicting than just sugar. Like, I've walked into rooms where people are snorting lines of cocaine. I've never walked into a room where people are just licking table sugar off the table or snorting table sugar. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's sugar by itself is not that sexy, you know? But when you mix in the combination of sugar, fat, salt, taste, texture, temperature, thickness, crunchiness, all of those things that are highly palatable, that does become addictive. And so, much like drugs and alcohol, these foods, they trigger a range of rewarding, feel-good neurochemicals, including dopamine, that just gives you a hit over and over and over again. And that is where the addiction part does kick in. Now, obviously, highly processed foods have this effect even when you're not hungry, in contrast to what we like to call real food, which is basically just whole, nutrient-dense, less processed or minimally processed or unprocessed foods. They're not as rewarding when you're not hungry, and it's usually easier to moderate your intake of those. That's why yesterday I was out doing this heat ruck, and I just had a message, and it's the same message we give to every corporate group we talk to, and we do these kind of 10, you know, pillars of importance in health, and I say eat real food. If it runs, it swims, it flies, it grows from the earth, eat it. If it comes in a bag or a box and it's highly processed, eat less of it. Because you self-regulate better with real food. Everybody I know does. I'm not saying there isn't outliers out there, but I've never ate 10 apples at one time. I've never eaten, you know, 80 stalks of asparagus. It just has never happened. You know what I have done is I've eaten 8 cinnamon rolls at one time. I've eaten a whole bag of chips at once. I've crushed 2 whole pizzas without blinking. And that's what I mean. The things that are real food, you tend to moderate your intake much better with those. So for a lot of people, eating whole, real, nutrient-dense foods is a much easier way to self-regulate and find yourself not on the binge cycle. But obviously these days, highly processed foods are super easy to get. They tend to be cheaper. They're readily available and accessible. And you have to rely on your ability to self-regulate and control behavior in order to resist them, because they are around every corner and they're in every conference room, work event, banquet, you name it. It's everywhere you look on every street corner in America is a fast food place, oftentimes with 2 or 3 lines that are packed 50 to 100 people deep. So it's tough, and I get it. And the people who deal with compulsive eating, or excuse me, compulsive like overeating, including those with food addiction, often have a hard time self-regulating. And here's why. People with compulsive overeating may have, number one, a struggle with impulse. They have a real hard time with impulse control, possibly because planning and strategizing, you know, the center of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, if you will, is impaired. This might be a hallmark of all addictions and contribute to poor recovery outcomes. The second thing, you react more easily and intensely to stressors. People who struggle here, they have a higher level of cortisol release than others. And because stress can trigger addictive behaviors, people who are more physically sensitive to stress may be more likely to use food, drugs, or alcohol as a way to cope. The next thing, these people tend to get more pleasure from food, at least at first. They may have a bigger dopamine response to highly processed foods, more motivation to seek out the response again, and stronger cravings because of it. The next one on the list, they get less pleasure from food over time. When you often overeat highly processed foods, the dopamine receptors become less responsive to those foods. That means the bigger hit of food will be required to get the same pleasurable effect. So again, just like if you ever, you know, alcohol, cigarettes, chewing tobacco, drugs, at first a little bit, gets you fucked up. It gets that dopamine response. It gets you that high that you've been chasing. And then over time, we have to do more and more and more to elicit the same response. And obviously, that dopamine release happens in the nucleus accumbens. So that's the region of the brain famous for its role in registering pleasure and reinforcing learning. And so there's a lot of things that give you these little dopamine boosts, like eating a tasty meal when you're hungry. We all know the feeling. Connecting with friends that you haven't seen in a long time. Maybe it's been a year. You know, I just got to see my best friend. I see him, you know, like once a year at this point, just because life, kids, travel, careers, you name it, you know, fucking time's moving, you know, 80 million miles a minute. We only get to see each other once a year. But it's like we never left. You know, it's like we can just get there, sit, chit chat. You know, I laugh more around him and can bullshit more with him than anybody else. There's a dopamine hit there, you know. You get one when you achieve your goals. You know, you set out to run a mile in under 6 minutes, or you want to dunk a basketball, or get your body fat under 10%, or, you know, fit into a size, whatever, or finish your master's degree. You name it. Achieving goals can give us a dopamine hit. However, certain activities and substances like drugs, gambling for sure, and yes, highly processed foods can produce unnatural high surges of dopamine. That's why people become more addicted to those than, you know, say doing split squats or, you know, eating asparagus or reading a book. You don't get, you know, the same dopamine hit from eating asparagus as you do from eating cinnamon rolls. At least I don't. And I think for some people, you know, you don't get the same dopamine hit, you know, gambling on a sports game or blackjack at the casino as you do from doing split squats. It's just, it'd be cool if it was the other way around. You know, we'd all be billionaires and look like Rambo, but unfortunately that is not the case. And so for a lot of people, that's why, because you get this unnatural high surge from things like, you know, alcohol, drugs, gambling, and again, the most highly palatable and processed manufactured foods. And here's why that becomes a problem. For a lot of people, the greater the dopamine response, the more pleasure you experience. And the more pleasure you feel, the more motivated you are to repeat it. It's common sense, right? It's the problem is, it's like when you put your hand on a stove and you burn your hand, it fucking hurts. And if you're not a complete dummy, you learn not to do it again. It's a reminder. Okay, you know, this is not good for me. This hurt. Let me make sure I don't do that in the future. If you're, you know, 100 pounds overweight and you keep eating cookies and cakes and chips and drinking alcohol excessively in a calorie surplus, you're going to keep gaining weight. But you keep chasing it because you keep getting this dopamine response. And the more pleasure you experience, the more motivated you are to feel that again and again and again. But what's really happening is you are burning your hand on the stove. That's what you're doing to your body. That's what's happening to it. You are actually harming yourself physically. The problem is that's not the response it's giving you in your brain. So you're chasing this thing that is burning you and tearing you down and making you, you know, fat, sick, unhealthy, and broken, yet it's a mind fuck because your brain is releasing this dopamine, and that is more pleasure for the experience. And so you keep chasing it over and over and over again. And obviously when you experience a dopamine surge, you learn to associate pleasure with a specific activity or substance that caused it, even though the very thing that is giving you the surge, the thing that you're associating with pleasure and awesome and fun, is the same thing that's fucking you up. It's why, you know, we've had social workers here. We've had a lot of people here. I've had a lot of people on this program who have fought addiction and went through AA, whether it be drugs, alcohol, pornography, gambling, you name it. And we joke, you know, with a lot of my friends that I grew up with, you know, I grew up with a lot of people that are addicted to gambling and alcohol and drugs. And it's a real thing. And it's tough because it's, you're starting to identify with the thing. It's giving you so much joy and happiness on one level, but on every other level, it's tearing you down and it's fucking you up and it's ruining your life. And so the people we have come in here, the social workers who have talked to us about people who are, you know, let's say homeless, for example, and obviously I'm giving you a sample size. This is not, you know, there's not research in front of me. There's a lot of people who are not living somewhere because they are addicted to drugs and alcohol. And their families sometimes have offered them a place to stay and live if they would just, you know, be willing to go through treatment and get clean. But that the addiction is so strong in them, they're picking that over the family to live, you know, in a house with people who are willing to take care of them, because the drugs and the alcohol have just this huge, strong hook on them. And for a lot of people, the food addictions is just as strong or even stronger in some cases. And so it's tough, man. You know, when you do experience this dopamine rush, you associate pleasure with the activity. So whether that's snorting cocaine or that's, you know, eating chicken fingers excessively, like that's what it is. And so as that learning continues, your prefrontal cortex, you know, and the reward system, it gets hijacked and you become focused on getting more of the thing, whether that be drugs, alcohol, or food. And you have trouble experiencing pleasure from anything else. And over time, your brain adapts to these kind of floods of dopamine. This is what's called tolerance. Your tolerance drives you to chase more of the pleasurable thing, yet you rarely feel satisfied. This, my friends, is the addiction cycle. Stress, depressed mood, anger, boredom, irritability are all common triggers of binge eating. And the binge eating often further triggers feelings of guilt and shame, and these feelings may promote more addictive behaviors, because binge eating and food addiction are associated with challenges regulating emotions. Food can be used as a way to self-medicate, and then obviously you temporarily feel better. And foods with sweet tastes are especially effective in elevating mood and suppressing pain. It's probably why people default to them more than anything else. And obviously food addiction is associated with the history of trauma, abuse, and is found alongside a number of other mental health disorders like depression, ADD, ADHD, psychosis, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And although many people think of addictive eating as a form of like self-sabotage, there's a more compassionate, useful way to think about it. For a person who is struggling, if that's you out there and food has become your, you know, for lack of a better term, like drug of choice, food is simply a safe space. And it's a comfort to turn when your life feels overwhelmed and stressed. Now, for me, and this is being completely transparent, in my adult life, I've been way better at not giving a fuck about things than obviously I did when I was a teenager. Very few things bother me. I don't feel stress at this high level because I have a different perspective. And I'll be honest with you, during the pandemic, I probably felt the worst that I've felt as an adult, for a lot of reasons. I just thought the whole thing was fucking bullshit. And a lot of it pissed me off. And there was a lot of, I didn't agree with things going on. I thought there was a lot of uncertainty, confusion, I felt not good. And if I would have been younger, I probably would have turned to alcohol and drugs as a coping mechanism. But because I've went through kind of those scales, the stress level for me was so high, I actually didn't want to eat at all, which is like the complete opposite. So food wasn't a safe space for me. It was just like, fuck it, I don't even want to eat. That's how, you know, overwhelmed I felt, like in the moment. But for some people who struggle and feel that level of stress, food does become the safe space for them. And they turn to it when they feel overwhelmed and the world is kind of crumbling around them. And so you probably know those people. There's some of you who are listening who, like, when you're super stressed and worried or whatever, you undereat. You're not even hungry at all. It kills your appetite because the stress is almost crippling. And then for some people, it's the opposite. It's where they turn to feel safe, if you will. And obviously, if you look at like animal research, addictive eating behaviors only happen when those guys are given, you guessed it, highly processed foods. And that isn't to say that, you know, processed foods cause addictive eating. It's just that their presence combined with other biological, psychological vulnerabilities makes food addiction more likely as the outcome. And obviously due to social factors, some people are exposed to highly processed foods more than others. imagine you're somebody who lives in like a food desert, right? It's an area that has, you know, poor access to affordable, fresh, minimally processed foods. There's no farmers markets. Maybe there's no farms. You live somewhere that there's only, you know, some of these small rural towns like in America. The closest place they have to pick up food is like a Dollar General. Sometimes they have a Walmart, maybe 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 miles away. That's like my version of like a food desert, right? Like they don't have access to affordable, fresh produce. And there's not a lot of minimally processed foods there just because of the structure of the business and how it's set up. And so if all you can get at your local, you know, kind of market is packaged snack foods, you know, if I give examples like white breads and canned fruit that has no fucking nutrients, you know, your nutrition and your appetite are going to be harder to manage because you don't have the same access. And similarly, if you don't have enough money to buy the healthiest of health foods on a regular basis, that can make an impact in your life. Naturally, what you might do, you know, like your ancestors, is stock up when you have the calories available, because you don't have the same access as we do here, especially if you don't have resources in front of you or you don't have the means, you know, to buy those things. And obviously, there's research that does support this, because higher rates of food insecurity are associated with disorders like binge eating, for example. And you can also pick up on social cues around food. If you've ever grown up with friends and family that regularly overeat or use food to kind of, you know, comfort or soothe or entertain, they might encourage you to do the same. And we've all been around, you know, people who do this with drugs and alcohol. There's drug pushers, there's alcohol pushers, and obviously there's food pushers as well. And even when you want to change, swimming against the current can be real tough to do, especially when you're in a scenario, you know, and, you know, the circle around you is tough and the environment is tough. It's why I always say, every time I talk to a group, I say, you know, my life is not probably like your life. I've created an environment and ecosystem that allows me to be successful. I've put guardrails in place. You know, I do my own grocery shopping and go to the grocery store every single day. I can make what I want. I can eat what I want. I don't have to go to any work dinners or business travel, and I don't have to do anything I don't want to do, for lack of a better term. I can get stuck at an airport or somewhere for sure where there's not, you know, 100% perfect choices, but it's very few and far between. It's real easy for me to be successful compared to people who are, you know, ice skating uphill at every single turn that comes their way. So that's food addiction in a nutshell for you guys. If we want to talk about three ways you can kind of tackle it, and if you're a fitness coach out there, there's kind of like three ways you can support your clients, or if you're somebody listening and you struggle, there's three ways you can kind of support yourself. Now, obviously, again, I'll say this, health and nutrition coaches, we can't diagnose or treat food addiction. We're not equipped to do that, or any kind of eating disorder for that matter. That's not what we do. We're not trained in it. We're not versed in that. I teach bear crawls for a living. I talk about behaviors, you know, for a living, but I'm not a medical professional. I can't diagnose what you do or don't have, but I can start the conversation. And what we all can do as health and fitness coaches or friends and family is you can be an essential part of the recovery team. And I'm not saying in a, you know, medical capacity, but there's so much more that goes into recovery and help than you even realize. And so if you're listening, say, well, Jeremy, how the hell can I do that? The first thing you can do is, one, create a safe, compassionate, encouraging environment for the people in your circle. If you have a friend, family member, or a client that comes to you with some deep shit, you know, don't feel like you have to figure out their childhood or fix their biology, because you can't. Instead, just focus on understanding their current situation, help them feel safe, listen before you talk, and just develop a trusting relationship. And the best way to do that is just practice empathy and just listen, man. Because people with addictions, like food addiction and binge eating disorder, may be more sensitive, you know, to reward. And then, you know, if you're a coach out there, you can also help your clients by, you know, rewarding them. And what does that mean? Just, you know, give them praise, man, when they do good, and celebrate every win, you know, that you see. And if a client you know, or a family member comes to you feeling, you know, shame or guilt over a certain behavior or feeling, reassure them that that's not them being a failure or them being inadequate, because failures happen. We all fuck up, dude. Missteps and imperfections are human, and feeling sensitive to them is just a sign that you want to do better yourself. That's all it is. So you're just a person who listens and you have empathy and compassion. I think you're going to get a lot more done with people if you can do it that way, for sure. And you just, you audit, you know, you question, you ask yourself, why did I do this when I say I wasn't going to do it? And how can I be better next time? Because it's not about being perfect. There's almost very few things in life you will ever do perfect. You know, your relationship with your husband or wife's not perfect. You don't invest perfect. You know, you don't always time everything right. You don't always have perfect workouts. You know, you don't have a perfect body awareness or perfect mobility. It's just, it's part of life. But if you can listen to people and just know if they're coming to you, they trust you. And if they feel shame or they feel guilt, just be there to listen and help them the best you can. And the first way you can do this is just by listening and being empathetic to the shit that they're going through. The second thing is, instead of only focusing on, you know, nutritional values and things like macros and just the calorie count, focus on how food makes your clients feel and makes you feel and makes the people around you feel. You know, you can ask with like a genuine, you know, kind curiosity, when you're eating, insert whatever trigger food that they eat, how do you feel in your body? And, you know, what thoughts come up? And sometimes it's uncomfortable. But that type of question can actually help people identify foods that do feel good in their bodies, that align with their values, and the ones that don't feel good in their bodies and then don't align with what they want to do. And over time, that can build a more positive, practical relationship with food. And that's what most people want to do at the end of the day. The next thing is, you can help people develop an awareness around their triggers. Just ask a simple question, you know, what's going on before you start feeling the urge to eat X, Y, and Z? Or what happens before you feel this urge to just, you know, mow down a whole box of Girl Scout cookies? Where were you? Who are you with? What happened? And how are you feeling right before and right after? And when you're aware of the patterns and the habits, it's easier to find opportunities to reroute them and stop them and slow yourself down in the heat of the moment. I know it's easier said than done, but the first step is to develop the awareness around why you're getting triggered so often, and then obviously how you react to it. And the next thing is just, you collaborate, you know, and come up with eating replacement activities, which I had to do this with chewing tobacco, and man, it was not fucking easy. Obviously stress is a common trigger for overeating. So you ask, you know, your client, your friend, you know, to make a list, or even yourself, you know, make a list of activities that'll calm you down and bring you joy. And note that, you know, overeating isn't the worst thing in the world and it's not forbidden, you know. And obviously you always have that option to use as a coping mechanism for shit. But over time, you choose other alternatives than just overeating. But it can help you slowly develop alternative behaviors, which over time you default to those. So again, my default used to be, you know, I had a stressful day, let me have a chew. I play video games, let me have a chew. I, you know, got shit-faced, let me have a chew. I just had a big meal, let me have a dip. So it used to be, okay, well, after a big meal, instead of having a chew, I need to get my ass up and go walk around outside, which, mind you, in the Midwest when it's February, it's real fucking rough to do. But there's a certain amount of suffering there that wakes you up and makes you realize like, wow, I don't need to do this. And some of the things I just stopped doing, like, in, you know, as a 22-year-old, did I really need to still be playing video games? Probably not. So I just stopped playing them because I'm like, this is a trigger for me to want to sit here and do this other thing. And the same thing, I used to, you know, go out and get shit-faced, which was not healthy for me either. And I'd always find myself, you know, when your inhibitions are lowered, talking myself into, you know, hey, just have a dip, it's not a big deal. And that started the cycle all back over again. So I stopped going out and getting so shit-faced that I couldn't control my actions afterwards. So replacing the behavior was one of the best things that I could do. personally, if that helps anybody out there. So if you're listening to this and you're struggling with food addiction, just know you're not the only person. Probably of all the 100 people you see at the grocery store, odds are 11, 12, 13 of those people are suffering right there with you. And just know in life and addiction in general, you're not supposed to do really hard things by yourself all the time. It often takes a team of support. That's why, you know, for a lot of people, I know it's different, but Alcoholics Anonymous is a great group. It's not just one person. You have a team. You go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You go have a sponsor. Like, your inner circle matters. And I say this a lot on this podcast, you know, if you're hanging out with a bunch of people who are not healthy and they're overeaters, or people who are, you know, alcoholics, or, you know, people who are addicted to gambling, or people who are always doing drugs, you're not going to change them. No matter how much you want to, you are not going to change them. But this is the saying, you can't change those people around you, but you can change the people around you. So meaning you can't change them and their behaviors. So you can't change those five people, but you can remove yourself and surround yourself with five different people. So you can't change the people around you, but you can change the people around you. So find good-ass people to put into your life, because it often takes a team to kick some really, really tough addictions. And talk to a trusted loved one for moral support. And again, if you need to, you consult a family doctor or a licensed, you know, like psychotherapist to get real professional help if you need to. And asking for help doesn't make you weak or soft or a failure. It just means that you have your own back, and it just means that you give a fuck and you're just willing to finally put your own mask on first so you can be happy, so everybody else around you can be happy and you can have a better life. That's it. I know a lot of times people think like, oh man, I don't want to go ask for help. It's like, if you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting the same result, that, my friends, I believe is a definition of insanity. But if you stop, slow down, audit, and reach out to people who are better equipped, have a different skill set, have a different viewpoint, and they can help you out, I think that's key. And I think that's crucial, especially when it comes to addiction, and food addiction is no different. And I want to do this episode one because it's a great piece, you know, that PN put together, and I'll put all the info in the show notes. But of all the things I've seen over the past, you know, I've been doing fitness since 2005, so 18 years. Food is the toughest, for sure. No, everybody doesn't have food addiction. Everybody doesn't have binge eating issues. But a huge number of people I see have a less than perfect or a less than healthy relationship with food and drugs and alcohol. And some people just one, and some people two, some people all three. And that's the biggest thing they struggle with. I can get people to come in here and beat the fuck out of themselves, man. I can get people to come in here and finally do mobility to build their body back up. I can get people to come in here and ride an assault bike for 500 calories. I can get people to come in here and do walking lunges for, you know, 15 minutes at a crack. I can get people to do some of the most gnarly stuff. We can build up their capacity. We can make them fit. We can make them strong. We can make them savages in the gym. That has become easy for me. And I've got a good number of people to change their habits, rituals, and routines when it comes to drinking and alcohol and even drugs for that matter, you know, to sleep or to cope. But that is for sure the hardest. It is the hardest thing for me to do, is to get people to really buy into eating a certain way, drinking a certain way, not abusing drugs and alcohol. It's really tough, man. And so if you're somebody out there listening, just know you're not alone. It's never easy, but the better team you have around you, the more transparent you are, the more you're willing to look yourself in the mirror and admit that there's something that's less than ideal here and it needs to be rectified, and you find good people in your corner, you're going to be successful. Will it be easy? Fuck no. It'll be hard. I've kicked a lot of things in my life. None of them were easy. They were all extremely difficult. And for a long time, even years afterwards, you were kind of fighting this urge, you know, to not go back because your mind will play tricks on you. But when you just have a good support system and you have people in your corner, when you talk it through, and you immerse yourself in a community and an environment that allows you to be successful, and you're around other people who are healthy, you'll be healthy too. And so that's my advice to anybody out there. So hopefully this helped any of you. If you struggle with the overeating or binge addiction or the certain things that go on, and just, you know, look at your habits week to week and see what you're doing and see if there isn't some places that you can improve. And whether that's, you know, creating a food journal or just writing down, you know, what your triggers are and noticing when you tend to overdrink or overeat, or maybe when you impulsively veer off the path of what you meant to do. And ask yourself, you know, why did I sell myself in the moment on having drinks when I said I wasn't going to? Why did I sell myself on, you know, crushing a whole pizza when I said I wasn't going to do it tonight? Why did I sell myself on going to the drive-thru when I said I was going to make dinner? Whatever it is, just start doing some auditing and questioning, and just know you're not going to win every battle. But over time, if you start to win more than you lose, that's when you kind of flip the script. Then you become somebody who owns their eating, and their eating doesn't own them. So take that 4 days, you guys. Hopefully this was helpful. Again, reminder, our 34-day ab and core challenge is kicking off here July the 17th. So the link is in the show notes. It's also in my Instagram bio. It's free for all app members. We're doing a free trip out to Scottsdale to hang out with us here. We're doing weekly prizes throughout of our friends at the Athletic Greens, JLab Pro, a lot of Jeremy Scott Fitness swag, Dry Farms Wine, Kettle and Fire Bone Broth. We're giving away a bunch of free shit because I like giving away free stuff. It makes me feel good selfishly. And again, if you're not inside the app, you can do a week for free and then stay on for a couple of pennies. These challenges we're giving away, you guys, we used to sell these for like $100 to $200, some of them plus. And almost all of them are free inside the app. And I mean, this year alone, the 47 days is the only one we've charged for. We've already ran like four challenges, right? We did the 47-day, we did the 40 days of fitness, we did the summer Metcon, and now this is the third free one. We'll do probably two more. So it's a lot of cool shit. Again, I pour my heart and soul into the app. I wanted to make the best thing possible. If you have a question, I always answer it in there. Not a lot of fitness people do that, but I really give a fuck about you guys. And I'm just dedicated to making you guys healthier and happier because it matters to me. Because if I'm not doing this, you know, what's this all about anyway? If I can't make you guys, you know, have a little bit better life. So that's in there. If you want a free sample of Athletic Greens or AG1, hit me up. I'll send you a sample pack right to your front door. You can try it for free. If you like it, we'll hook you up with a year supply of vitamin D and five free travel packs with order one. But again, please ask. I'm happy to send out the free samples. And then if you guys are not in our newsletter, hit me up. I'll add you to the newsletter. We send out three emails a week, every week for 52 weeks. Our YouTube page is free. Jeremy Scott Fitness on YouTube. There's almost 2,000 videos on there. We pump out new videos every single week, and I think that is it. If you got anything else from me, obviously hit me up. If you're on Apple Podcast, drop it a 5-star, leave a comment, I'd appreciate it. If you're on Spotify, drop us a 5-star there too. Selfishly, it helps us. And if you like this episode and you think it can help anybody you know, share it with a friend or family member. It means a lot to us. And if you share it on Instagram and like Facebook, just tag us in it. I'm happy to reshare it, and I appreciate you guys sharing our message and listening. So I appreciate you. Have an amazing rest of your Friday, and I'll either talk with you guys Sunday or I'll be on next Friday as well, depending on what we got cooking here. So until next time, eat well, train hard, be nice to people, and please, you guys, keep doing shit you love with people you enjoy, because your life is too short not to. I'll talk to you soon. Peace.